Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. May it please the Court. The principal issue on the liability side of this case is, of course, one of legal causation. And this Court's decisions have made it clear that in these kinds of common law retaliatory discharge cases, the critical injury is causation. As recently as last year, the Court in writings held that for a wrongful discharge claim to be actionable, it has to be shown that the discharge was caused by or the result of the employee's invocation of a protected right under the Illinois Workers' Comp Act. In the Hyatt Court, similarly, which I think is probably the seminal Seventh Circuit decision regarding these retaliatory discharge cases, says that it's the burden of the plaintiff to affirmatively show that the discharge was primarily in retaliation for the exercise of a protected right. And the Hyatt Court further said that the element of causation is not met if the employer had a valid basis, which is not pretextual, for discharging the employee. So with that legal framework, I'd now like to review briefly the record evidence below. And the evidence, we think, shows that the plaintiff, Bruce Casanova, was fired almost immediately after he was deceptive and insubordinate to management during a hearing or an inquiry provided for under Section 29F of the collective bargaining agreement between American and its union. And American has a written policy stating that insubordination and dishonesty and misrepresentation of facts are grounds for immediate termination. And the record evidence shows that Mr. Casanova was aware of the policy. It was read to him. He chose to disobey it, and he was terminated almost immediately thereafter.
Did the insubordination involve a refusal to change something on a form? Is that what it was?
Refusal, after Mr. Casanova was evasive, deceptive, and dishonest, the record shows that the frustrated American manager directed him to write out in his own handwriting a narrative of his activities in question. He refused, even though his union steward, who was there to represent him, counseled him to refuse. He was instructed that if he refused, he would be terminated. He refused. And that is the insubordination. And you can see what the plaintiff's excuse for that insubordination is on appeal. In his brief, he argues, well, there was no written rule requiring me to write out a written statement. Well, that excuse misses the point because there is a written workplace conduct rule requiring all employees to obey the directives of management, whether they be oral or written. And so that was the insubordination. The lying just occurred when he was repeatedly asked to describe his activities, and at trial, when I cross-examined him, and his testimony is at pages 80 through 81 of the appendix, he explained that he was not truthful because, quote, I needed to have her stop interrogating me, end quote. That was his testimony. By his own admission, he said that he, quote, said almost anything, end quote, in the Section 29F hearing. Well, our response is it's not his prerogative to lie and be insubordinate in order to avoid having answered questions under his own union's Section 29F hearing. So you will see that there is a very close temporal nexus between his lying and insubordination on one hand and his termination on the other. And that, we think, is the valid grounds for his termination. Now, of course, he argued below, and he argues on appeal, that that was just all of a pretext and that he was really terminated in retaliation for accepting benefits and medical care that American facilitated and provided on his behalf several weeks earlier. And you can see in the district court's opinion the kind of hodgepodge of circumstantial evidence that was relied upon to support the notion of a pretext. The district court said that American had discretion to impose some lesser punishment.
And you're making me dizzy. If you would just stay rooted to one place on the floor, I'd appreciate it.
I will try to do that, Your Honor. The district court cited evidence that American had discretion to impose some less severe sanction than termination, but that ground has been rejected or disposed of previously by this court's jurisprudence, the Hyatt case, the Horton case, the Roger case. Basically, this court and the Illinois courts have held that it is not for a trial court or a jury to decide or prescribe how employers should discipline their employees. That there may be some lesser sanction available is of no legal import. The district court also cited the fact that American was aware that Mr. Casanova had prior injuries and indeed had, on occasion, over the 20-some years of employment, filed prior workers' comp claims. But that ground as well, Your Honors, has been precluded by the jurisprudence of this court and the Illinois courts that say that mere knowledge that an employee has had prior injuries or prior workers' comp claims cannot be grounds for a retaliatory discharge claim, because otherwise it would immunize the employee from discharge for otherwise valid grounds. And the district court also cited supposedly evidence of disparate treatment. And indeed, under the Workers' Comp Act, you cannot discriminate or interfere with a worker's rights under the Act. But here the evidence cited was the fact that a Mr. Harrington, who was a senior security officer at American, a former Chicago police officer, checked out with permission an unclaimed camera from the Lost and Found. He didn't lie about it. He had permission. He wasn't deceptive about it. He didn't steal it. And we think that that is a wholly unsimilar situation and not comparable to Mr. Casanova's deliberate violation of Americans' rules. Another thing the district court cited was the fact that American was paying Mr. Casanova's medical benefits and temporary total disability benefits. We think that that evidence, far from showing a pretext, shows that the employer was motivated not to interfere with the employee's workers' compensation rights. And our conclusion is spot on with that which was reached by the Third Circuit in the Acker versus Coca-Cola case, which we cite. And there the court said, well, basically, that when an employer promptly reports the injury and facilitates the benefits, that hardly shows a pretext or an intent to interfere. It shows, to the contrary, that the employer was intent on complying with the Workers' Comp Act. So that was the hodgepodge of evidence that the district court cited. I want to spend a minute on the pain and suffering award, if I may. The jury tacked on $250,000 in pain and suffering award, and we think that award has to be reversed under this court's decision in Avitia. I think that's how you pronounce it. But in any event, in that case, the very similar here retaliatory discharge case, the plaintiff offered no medical evidence, but just testified subjectively that after the termination he felt like the Sears Tower had fallen on him and he was depressed. And the court there said, well, with that kind of subjective evidence, that will support only a nominal award at most, and it remitted the award down to $10,000. Here the evidence is the same. Mr. Casanova testified according to the same script that was criticized in Avitia. He testified he felt like a broken toy and was depressed. Significantly, in the almost, I think it was over 3 years between his injury and the time of trial, he did not seek any medical attention for this alleged pain and suffering, except that conveniently right before trial, he said he went to see a doctor. We don't know what the doctor found or said because Mr. Casanova did not call the doctor to testify. So we think under Avitia, the pain and suffering award has to be reversed. And let me conclude finally with the punitive damage award. As weak as the liability and pain and suffering findings were, the punitive judgment award, we think, is even weaker and did not pass scrutiny for three reasons. First of all, the Illinois Supreme Court has made it clear that a punitive damage award has to be based on some conduct over and above the conduct that is necessary for the underlying liability. And here, the district court, we called that precedent to the district court's attention. I'm not certain that the district court acknowledged it. In any event, we see both the district court and the plaintiff relying on the same hodgepodge of circumstantial evidence for the underlying liability as well as the punitive damage award. The second problem with the punitive damage award, of course, is that the Illinois Supreme Court has made very clear that there's a very high standard for the conduct that qualifies for a punitive damage award. The plaintiff has the burden of showing that the conduct rises to the level of outrage, quasi-criminal, that kind of conduct that offends all social norms. And to state the obvious, there's no such record here in this case. American fully facilitated this man's processing of his claim, fully paid it for years, respected his contractual rights to have a union steward represent him at the 29F hearing. There's no evidence that American is a repeat violator of the Illinois Workers' Comp Act. To the contrary, the evidence is there are 1,650 employees who've had between 10 and 30 workers' comp claims over the years. None of them have ever been terminated. And here, his own union thought the process was fair and did not pursue a grievance on his behalf. So there's absolutely nothing in the record that would support a punitive damage award under this court.
I take it, counsel, that because there's no argument made on appeal about the jury instructions in the case, that the jury was properly instructed on both the substance of the claim, in particular the element of causation that appears to be the focal point of the appeal, as well as the criteria for both of the damages awards?
You're correct. We have not raised an issue on appeal as to the jury instructions.
So the jury got the right instructions on what Illinois law requires for emotional distress damages in a claim of this sort and the right kind of instruction on punitives?
I believe they did. I believe that the evidence does not support the verdict, though, and that on Rule 50, it's this court's obligation and our right to challenge the legal sufficiency of that evidence. I'll reserve the rest of my time, if I may, for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Drummond.
May it please the court. Listening to Mr. Anderson quarrel about what the district court did, you would think that this was a bench trial. This was indeed a jury trial. And as the court just pointed out, there is no issue regarding the jury instructions. The jury was properly instructed, and they were properly instructed on the punitive damage elements, the compensatory damage elements, and the elements of the case, and the fact that we must have proved to their satisfaction that there was retaliation, and it was retaliation for the exercise of Mr. Casanova's rights. The fact that American paid him his workers' compensation payments was not at issue in this case. That was offered at trial by American. What was at issue was his termination, and whether the termination was related to his presentation of the workers' compensation claim. Within 24 hours of him presenting his claim, reporting his injury, seeking medical treatment, all of those things being the exercise of his rights under the Act, under the Hinthorn decision, he apparently lifted a cell phone with his left hand, his left arm, which was injured, and this triggered all kinds of red flags, and surveillance was conducted within 24 hours, actually the next morning. The surveillance that was conducted, according to the reports, for the purpose of a theft determination and workers' compensation fraud. As we pointed out in our brief, the surveillance and when it was conducted versus the medical restrictions and when they were imposed didn't jive or didn't harmonize. The people who conducted the 29F hearing claimed that Mr. Casanova was exceeding his medical restrictions and that he was misrepresenting his medical condition and that somehow he had obtained a benefit to which he was not entitled. Well, we know he didn't obtain a benefit to which he was not entitled because he continued to receive it even up to the point of trial.
Counsel, the issue of whether or not there was cause to initiate an investigation and surveillance and an Article 29F hearing and so forth, it doesn't really have anything to do with whether he was fired in retaliation for exercising his workers' compensation rights. What the proper focus is whether those who made the decision to fire him for insubordination and for lying at that Rule 29F hearing or Article 29F hearing actually believed that he had lied and committed insubordination, or whether that was a pretext. But if they had grounds to believe it and actually did believe it, and there isn't any evidence to undermine that, then, you know, whether it was a good idea or appropriate to initiate surveillance, whether there was justification to initiate surveillance and a 29F hearing really doesn't matter.
Certainly.
What evidence is there that these decision makers didn't believe that they had grounds, that is, dishonesty and insubordination, to terminate him?
Well, I believe the evidence that there was no insubordination was provided by another employee, Leslie Crowe, who discussed what the purpose of the statement was in the 29F hearing, and she stated that the purpose of the statement in the 29F hearing was for the employee's benefit so the employee could put in anything they wanted. Kim Rausch, who conducted the...
I'm not sure how that responds to the argument. Are you arguing that American had a policy under which employees were entitled to refuse direct orders? See, I could imagine either there's a statement in the handbook that says something like, this hearing is for your benefit, so if you refuse to cooperate, there won't be any adverse consequences. Then, if they fire him for refusing to cooperate, that would be a problem. Or you could imagine evidence that was something like, lots of people refused to cooperate in these hearings, but the only guy who was fired was the one who had made multiple compensation claims. That would go a long way. Did you offer either of those kinds of evidence?
No, Your Honor. We offered the evidence that what transpired at the 29F hearing.
Do you have any reason to believe that anybody who has behaved like your client in the history of American Airlines has ever kept his job? Right, you hold a hearing to ask the employee a question, and to every question he says, I don't recall. You then ask him the question, are you going to say, I don't recall, to every question I ask? And he says, I don't recall. It's very difficult to imagine that the next two words out of the person's mouth won't be, you're fired. Is there any person who has ever behaved like this and not been fired?
I'm not aware of all the transcripts in the 29F hearings, Your Honor.
Was it that incident was described by your opposing counsel? When I read your brief, I don't quite get the same feel. Tell me again what happened. Did he make a written statement? Then he
made a written statement, Your Honor, and that statement is attached to the appendix at Appendix 64. And in the statement, he stated that he was asked to discuss the circumstances of his injury and his driving activities. He said in the statement, he said, what I said in the report and what I said in the Board of Inquiry investigation was accurate and that I reported the circumstances of my injury correctly. He said, in terms of my driving activities, I've answered them to the best of my recollection in the 29F hearing. Then he was told that that statement was insufficient. And then he said, I will stand on the statement. I think the jury saw the statement. This was an exhibit for the jury. And they apparently believed that the statement comported with what was requested.
So the hearing officer, or the woman who was asking the questions, said, do it again. And he said, I can't do it again. I told you the way it happened.
He said, I stand on the statement. In other words, I've complied. And the jury did not believe that was insubordination. I think the jury had additional...
Was the jury instructed on in this area?
The jury was instructed The jury was not instructed as to what insubordination was. The jury was instructed that if American had any legitimate reason to fire Mr. Casanova, then the verdict should be for American. That's what the jury was instructed. And with respect to the hearing itself, I think the trial judge's comment is relevant. Judge Guzman stated, I mean, if the jury believes the plaintiff's version of the interrogation he went through, it was at the very least mean, spirited, and quite possibly vicious. According to him, he was reduced to an emotional state of being very distraught by the end of it. There's testimony to support that. Whether the jury believes it or not is something else. In this case, I think it's rather evident that the jury did believe that this was a mean-spirited meeting and that Mr. Casanova was being interrogated in a manner which was unfair, and that this was a...
That's not the appropriate focus in a retaliatory discharge case. You know, whether the investigation was justified or fair, either the surveillance aspect of it or the Article 29F aspect of it, was really just the backdrop here. It's not the focus of the claim.
Well, was the jury entitled to assess whether or not the 29F hearing was in and of itself pretextual?
My question goes to what is required as a matter of proof on a retaliatory discharge claim. And the Illinois courts require that the discharge be the primary reason for the discharge be the employee's exercise of workers' compensation rights. And so that focuses on the reason for the termination. And the reason given for the termination here was the lying and the insubordination. And your client admitted in his trial testimony, as I understand it, that he didn't tell the truth at that hearing. And whether the reason he didn't tell the truth was because he felt like he was being badgered and the procedure was unfair and he just wanted to bring the whole thing to a close. But the fact remains that he admitted on the witness stand that he didn't tell the truth. And that seems to me to fatally undermine your claim.
I think he stated that he never intended to lie. I think lying requires intent. I think he...
What we're focusing on is whether the decision-makers who fired him had a reasonable belief that he had lied, and therefore their reason for terminating him was not pretextual for retaliation on the basis of the exercise of his workers' compensation rights. That's the appropriate focus here. And it seems to me that most of this trial focused on the backdrop events.
Well, the trial focused on his reporting his claim, his exercise of his rights, and the fact that he was terminated within 3 weeks of that. And that he was terminated, apparently, if one believes the decision makers, he was terminated because allegedly he had 2 library books in his left hand, and he drove a motor vehicle. At times when his restrictions did not prevent him from doing so. So the jury was confronted with, is this the reason why he's being fired? For carrying a couple of library books and driving a motor vehicle? Or is he being fired for some other reason? That's what the jury was looking at. And the jury heard his testimony about his conduct in the 29F hearing. And the jury was presented with the same argument at trial as to whether or not he was a liar and whether or not his termination was justified and whether or not he was insubordinate. And the jury did not determine that he was insubordinate or a liar. I mean, I believe these are questions of fact for the jury. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to try to address them.
Thank you very much, Mr. Drummond.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Anderson?
I'll be brief. The issue, as I think we've correctly identified, is one of causation and not the issue that Mr. Drummond skillfully argued to the jury. His argument was that American had not been fair to the plaintiff here. There is absolutely no evidence in the record that either of the hearing officers, Ms. Rouse or Ms. Rios, were insincere in their belief that this plaintiff had been insubordinate to them and had not accurately represented the facts. And I would like to point out that Rule 16, American's Rule 16, I've used the term lying to loosely describe what he did, but the rule prohibits any misrepresentation of facts. And I don't think you can look at this record and say that this is a man who was trying to be candor. And finally, on the issue of the written statement, that appears in the appendix as Exhibit 7. And it was Joint Exhibit 7 at page 64. And the record shows that after Mr. Casanova repeatedly said, well, first of all, he falsely denied driving or using his arm. And then when he figured out it wasn't going well, he began saying, I don't recall every question. And then when he was asked whether I don't recall was going to be the sum total of his statement, he answered, I don't recall. And then the frustrated hearing officer directed him then to write out a narrative of what happened, the dates he did things, where he went, what he did. He first refused. The union steward counseled him to do it. And then he wrote out the statement that appears in the appendix at age 64. And it's not a statement that is anyway a narrative of what happened. He said he wrote out, quote, by forcing me to write this statement at this time, I think he left out the word American, has inflicted severe emotional distress upon me. The misrepresentations by AA has gone beyond the bounds of decency. The procedures that American Airlines uses are harassing and intimidating me. That was dissent. You can read the rest of it, but he didn't write out a narrative. And then they again instructed him to do it, and he refused, and then they fired him. That concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.